Nice to be back here speaking again. I think I was last here, what, a year ago? A year ago. Since a year ago, the world has become increasingly more interesting, if you want to put it that way. I travel on every habitable continent of the world. I've been doing that for over 3 decades. What do I see? My observations tell me that there is a great need for a different kind of culture. What we are grappling with today is a culture that's spread over the world, a culture that knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. Human civilization today is very price conscious. The economy is the number one issue. So much so that, as many of you know, even environmental issues always take a back seat to economic issues. If we're going to change the kind of culture we have today, we indeed have to consider what is value. And as soon as you start making value judgments, then you are dealing with the question of human identity. Now, we can ignore the issue of human identity by focusing on social or political issues, governmental failings, failings of institutions. But we won't get to the bottom of the problem in this way. As long as human beings don't understand their identity, or even consider that that's an important question, then we're not going to be able to affect meaningful change. What the ancient yoga texts of India tell us is that first grapple with identity issues, and then everything else follows. But if we ignore identity issues, then we'll be forever like a cat chasing its own tail. We won't be able to get to the root of our problems. If we're going to change the culture of today from price culture to a value culture, then we need wisdom. So what I'm speaking about today is indeed the need for a wisdom culture, a culture that values wisdom about human identity and human purpose above any price knowledge. Because remember, in order to deal with value, you're dealing with value judgments. So what is the nature of the entity that's making value judgments? In order to establish a wisdom culture, we need to understand what is the nature of the creature that is valuing, making value judgments. A great detriment to our attempts to establish a wisdom culture is our tendency to avoid dealing with consciousness. What is consciousness? Why do we have it? It is consciousness that values, makes value judgments. But as long as we consciously or unconsciously consider consciousness to be like any other, like some kind of matter, whether it's this microphone stand or this cloth, as long as we consider consciousness in that way, we'll have a very difficult time understanding what is value and what makes value judgments. We might consider that the human being is a lump of meat, a meat system. And from that meat system, known as the human being, comes special meat known as consciousness. In other words, as long as we consider, without any proof whatsoever, that consciousness is material, it's going to be very difficult for us to enact deep-seated change in society, in ourselves. When we look at Bhagavad Gita, the prime yoga text, not simply in terms of asanas or yoga postures, but in terms of understanding identity and what our identity is connected to. When you look at Bhagavad Gita, we find that the first lesson is about the difference between consciousness and matter. I often point out in my travels that scientific reactions to what is consciousness fall into three camps. The first camp says that consciousness is material, there's no doubt about it, even though there's no proof, and just accept that and move on. The second camp says that we don't know what consciousness is. We may never know. And the third camp says, certainly, consciousness is something of it in a different category from material subject matter. What I'd like to present to you is a very provocative concept. Because we have failed to grapple with what is consciousness, we cannot effectively solve so many other problems, whether they are economic, environmental, social, political, unless we know what is it that is allowing us to perceive. What's the medium by which we are aware of economics, politics, the environment? What is it that allows human beings, at least let's understand human beings, what is it that allows human beings to have awareness, to have perceptions, to make value judgments, to have knowledge? Without understanding that, we haven't gotten to the root of our problems. Now, you may notice I'm referring to human beings. According to the ancient yoga texts, human beings are not the only creatures that have consciousness. But I don't want to, in this short time period we're allotted, I don't want to take things further afield. At least if we can understand that human beings have consciousness, and we need to understand what that consciousness is, and how to nourish consciousness. At least if we can understand that, it can be a great step forward. If I have a car, I understand the car needs oil, it needs petrol. I have consciousness, but what does it need? What nourishes consciousness? So the ancient yoga texts tell us straightly that what nourishes consciousness is not material. The sustenance for enlivening consciousness is not material. So where do we find the non-material enrichment for our consciousness? This is the most important question for human beings. Now you may say that, well, there are people starving in this world. There are people living in poverty. We have to deal with that. Some of you may know the statistics that the amount of persons starving this world are matched by approximately the same amount that have obesity problems. So again, you see that there may not be a shortage of resources in this world. Instead, there may be a problem of consciousness that some persons, due to low consciousness, are taking more than what they need, and others are not getting what they need. So once again, if we can understand the root of the situation, consciousness, what is it? How is it nourished? We can save ourselves a lot of trouble on the individual level and on the macro level. If the human being mistakes his or her identity as matter, then that human being is going to struggle trying to achieve matter and arrangements of matter for satisfaction. But as soon as you understand that you as a conscious entity are not material, then you won't compete and vie and grapple for matter as a source of satisfaction. So understanding our true identity as non-material slackens our grip, slackens our acquisitiveness, and reduces the pressure that human beings place on this world, trying to satisfy themselves with something that won't satisfy them. If we are non-material, then we need to seek out non-material sources of satisfaction and nourishment. So in this way, I hope you can understand that the real purpose of the yoga system is not simply physical health. There's nothing wrong with that. The real purpose is how to make the ultimate connection between the individual unit of consciousness and the supreme consciousness. In that relationship is packed the nourishment and satisfaction that we need. But as long as we think we are products of matter, we're not going to understand how to nourish ourselves, how to satisfy ourselves. Will be like running out into the desert looking for water. We can understand that there are laws of nature that have been observed, and these laws of nature describe arrangements in nature and make predictions based on observation. Now, the laws of nature that are accepted widely, how do they affect consciousness? It's only because of consciousness that the set of laws of nature we know about today have been discerned. We're aware of things because of our consciousness. So my point is that if we don't understand consciousness, then we actually don't understand what we're observing. So we've kind of put the cart before the horse. First, let's understand what we are observing, and don't ask childish questions about the nature of the observer. This is going to cause big problems, socially, politically, economically. And even in our understanding of the universe, there are going to be big problems. What are the laws of nature that deal with consciousness? Some founding fathers of quantum mechanics have pointed out that there will probably be a different set of laws of nature that apply to consciousness, because consciousness cannot be described in material terms, and no one knows any laws of nature that deal with consciousness. The ancient yoga texts, such as Bhagavad Gita, describe that in what we know as material existence, consciousness and matter are interacting, although they're different substances. And these different substances both emanate from the same source. So it's not that consciousness, which the yoga texts say indicates a spiritual energy, it's not that consciousness just exists out of nowhere and matter just exists out of nowhere. They both can be traced to a common source. Just like the sun gives off both heat and light. Heat and light can be traced to the sun. Similarly, Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that matter and consciousness can be traced to the Supreme Consciousness. So now we're thinking, well, that sounds plausible, but how can we actually experience such a reality? Theory is nice, conceptions are nice, but no doubt what's even nicer is direct experience. If there's a higher reality, I want to experience that. Indeed, there is a laboratory for direct experience of the spiritual reality. That is what Krishna speaks about in Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna invites you not for belief, not for theory, but for direct perception of the real self by laboratory experience. But first we have to be induced to enter that laboratory, because we can come up with so many reasons why it's not important. And looking at the way society is structured today, we can understand how someone would come to that conclusion. I've got so many other things to worry about than who I am and what I am. I have school pressures, job pressures. I have the pressures of my daily desires and wants. You may notice that so many people today have a problem distinguishing between wants and needs. And they feel the pressure all the time. What do I really want? What do I really need? Can I get what I really want? And can I get what I really need? And how are the two different? What I want and what I need? And even when they get what they want / need, they're not satisfied. I like to point out how I was speaking at University of Cape Town. Actually, that's where I met your announcer here. And I asked the students, along with the professors gathered there, you all are aware of the new science of happiness, and how it's a generally accepted assertion that beyond a basic level of middle-class income and acquisitions, any further increase does not lead to an increase in satisfaction and happiness as measured by standard psychological indicators. Well, the audience at that time was about 200 students and professors. So I said, you know, this is the most prestigious institution, University of Cape Town, on the African continent. I'm sure you're aware of this. Everyone raised their hands. Yes, yes, we're all aware of it, and generally we accept it. Generally. There's always some pot shots you can take, but we generally accept that beyond a basic middle class standard of income and opulence, any further increase does not lead in an increase in happiness or satisfaction as measured by standard psychological indicators. All right, accepted, generally. Then I asked the audience of 200 students and professors, all right, you all know this, you're the top students on the African continent. How many of you are prepared to live on a basic middle class standard of living? Out of 200, maybe 3 raised their hands. So I'm bringing this example up to show you that there's a gap between theory and what we actually do. So therefore, if we're actually going to cope with what is my identity, we want to get beyond simply theory and have some hands-on laboratory experience. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives you the ideas and directs you to the tools for applying those ideas. In chapter 2, it is explained that before we go any further, we have to understand the difference between the body and the self. It's not that the body comes out of nowhere and the self comes out of nowhere, but still they are different. The first step in education is to understand that the body and the self function under different laws. So if you understand the laws that govern matter, that doesn't mean you understand the laws that govern the real self. The fact that we don't understand consciousness should alert us to the fact that something else is going on. Now you may say, well, in the future, consciousness will be understood according to known materialistic vision, paradigm, etc. But you see, from the viewpoint of material science, no one even knows what it is that they're grappling with in terms of consciousness. Where does it come from? Why do we have it? It doesn't show up directly on any scientific instrument in the world. There's no scientific instrument in the world that can directly detect consciousness. Simply, consciousness can be inferred in various ways. So, my point today is that if we are willing to experiment upon ourselves, not blindly, but according to the precise spiritual science methods given in the ancient yoga texts, especially we're speaking of Bhagavad Gita, which is the quintessential yoga text. If we're feeling the motivation to do that, we can profit so much and get real value rather than just knowledge of prices. But in today's society, knowledge of prices is all important. And therefore, people don't know how to value. They don't know what is valuable. And it's a great tragedy in terms of the loss of human energy. So much effort, so much hard labor, so much struggling. And where is the satisfaction? As you know, human beings have become the first species to attain the dubious honor of spoiling its own habitat. No other species does that. That shows there's a problem in consciousness. In spite of the gift of developed consciousness that human beings have, they're not using it in the right way. So let's briefly return to discussions about laws of nature. Laws of nature, as known today, are just descriptions of how things in nature are supposed to act. and also predictions that, given these circumstances, such things will continue to happen. But these laws of nature, as given to us today, have nothing in them about causality. Laws of nature don't cause things. They're not agents of that make things happen. And they don't bring any power to bear on situations. Laws of nature don't do that. They don't cause, and they don't bring the necessary power for things to happen. They're simply descriptive. So if we say that the laws of nature are responsible for everything, this is very childish. And then, not only do we have to describe how laws of nature bring into being matter, we also have to describe how the laws of nature, as presented to us today, bring into being consciousness. In Bhagavad Gita, we find the science of the finite consciousness and the supreme consciousness. In particular, Bhagavad Gita deals with bhakti yoga, described by Krishna as being the top rung on the yoga ladder. The postures, the breathing exercises are for calming your mind so that indeed you can focus on what is the ultimate goal, what is the highest reality. Sometimes, though, and often, people get stuck just with the postures and the breathing. Simply, good health, can't object to good health. But actually, the postures and the breathing are meant to calm us down, chill us out, so we can focus on what is the ultimate reality. And we can't forget that ultimate reality. Otherwise, we'll never understand what the self is. The self is part of the ultimate reality. So bhakti yoga deals with the relationship between the finite self, the tiny particle of spiritual consciousness, and the supreme consciousness. And bhakti yoga presents laws of a different type. Laws that govern the use of consciousness. Some of you may have heard the term karma. It's very popular these days, but karma actually involves laws that apply to consciousness. Just like when dealing with matter, we accept that every action has a reaction. But what about consciousness? What are the reactions to conscious behavior? Western science doesn't understand that because, first of all, Western science has a big problem with consciousness itself. They don't know what it is. They can't directly test for it. And it's very upsetting for our materialistic lifestyles to consider that consciousness is non-material, because then you have to accept a completely different reality along with the ordinary reality that we perceive. So karma refers to laws of nature governing consciousness. As a conscious entity, you have to be held accountable for your actions, and your actions will bring about certain reactions. Briefly, we can explain that the very body that we have is a reaction to conscious actions we've done in the past. What goes around comes around. It's true not only in terms of matter, but it's also true in terms of our conscious actions. So, if we can understand consciousness, and that means understanding its relationship to the supreme consciousness, then we can actually see a complete picture of our human condition. Of course, once someone becomes sensitive to the real human condition, that means not just the body, but also the consciousness, the non-material particle of spiritual consciousness, known in Sanskrit as the Atma, loosely translated in English as the soul. Once you understand that, you begin to wonder about other living entities. You can see that human beings have more developed consciousness than your pet dog or your pet cat. You begin to wonder about all life forms. But at least first we should understand consciousness in human beings and how to nourish that consciousness. And then we can expand our vision to start taking into account other laws of nature not known by... ordinarily not known. And this way our whole vision opens up and we can see greater possibilities for human development. Greater possibilities for actually getting to the root of human problems. It's like you're driving a car and you never realize the car needs petrol. And so the car stops going. And you're wondering, what's going on? What's going on? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? What are the economic solutions, political solutions, social solutions? Hey, how about putting some petrol in the tank? Similarly, in terms of our own individual crises and the crises of human beings, it seems we're looking everywhere except... what actually is the self? And it could be that there's some fear. If we start considering a non-material identity, our whole life can just go topsy-turvy. So finally, I'd like to point out that in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna presents a balanced program for dealing with both our material needs and our non-material needs. It's just that the enlightened person doesn't mistake himself or herself as matter, and therefore doesn't put the emphasis in life on trying to satisfy the self through material acquisition, material achievement, material gratification, and so forth. So in conclusion, if we consider our non-material identity, consciousness lets you know there's a non-material identity for you. Consciousness cannot be understood materially, and that should let us know that our real self cannot be understood materially. We need a different paradigm of science, and we need different laws of nature that will account for the actions and reactions of conscious entities. So this is just a brief introduction to the exciting world of Bhagavad Gita. These are some fundamental lessons given by Krishna in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. And if we can master the fundamental lessons, then we can indeed proceed to transform ourselves as individuals in the most powerful way, and we can think about transforming society. So, I thank you very much for your kind attention.